This episode is brought to you with support from the 70 Million Podcast. And a quick warning before you listen, we will be talking about some violent incidents.
Hey, Martin. It's Deputy Siegel with the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office. I understand that you don't want to get out of the van. Do you mind just putting both of your hands on the steering wheel for me so I can see them? Perfect. Thanks, Martin.
It was late August 2019. Deputy Jordan Siegel approached a white van parked on a mountain road in the woods of Santa Cruz County. Other deputies were down the road. They were interviewing the driver's friend.
We came up here because his dad passed away recently, and he's been really depressed, and it's just been going downhill, and he really wants to, like, he said he wanted to kill himself. I was trying to get him to talk to a counselor and get him to see therapists, and so he pulled out the knife, and he put it up, like, pointed it towards me and said that he's going to kill me. He says, well, I'll fucking kill you, then I'll kill myself.
Deputy Siegel stayed by the van, calmly talking to the suicidal driver.
So what were you doing with your buddy today? Just talking? What were you talking about? He said that you were, making some comments that you might want to hurt yourself.
Well, yeah, it's been a rough year.
But you won't be able to get a job if you hurt yourself.
I don't know. It doesn't matter anymore.
After a few minutes of talking, Deputy Siegel convinced the driver to hand over his knife.
Can you drop the knife? Oh, that's perfect.
We're not coming out.
NECOM 3-8, we're negotiating with him. The weapon's outside of the van now.
We're done negotiating. I'm not getting out. You guys can sit here. I'll just stay here all day. Not getting out. I'm going to kill myself and...
3-6 or 3-8. The deputies were getting worried that Martin might turn on the engine and try to run them over, or take off and hurt himself. So while Deputy Siegel tried to coax Martin out of the van, his colleagues made a plan to force him out.
Break your glass so they can control his hands, trying to pull him out of the driver's side.
A few minutes later, Martin started the van.
Can you give me the keys?
Break your glass.
Breaking glass.
Sorry, Scotty. Everything you've heard until now was part of a training exercise at the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department. Martin and his friend were really deputies playing roles. And that noise you heard as the other deputies pretended to break the window, it was supposed to be pepper spray, but really they sprayed water.
Just your water pressure.
That was impressive.
It hurt a little bit.
Yeah.
Training like this is going to become more common across California as law enforcement agencies respond to new limits on when police can use deadly force and requirements for more de-escalation training. The whole point of this role play is to teach deputies how to resolve tense situations without firing their guns. They go through lots of scenarios that involve people in psychological distress. Some are suicidal, others are mentally ill. The deputies learn to address them with a calm voice, to assign one officer to keep a conversation going while the others make a tactical plan. They learn to use their words and their body language to basically just slow things down.
Things to remember, nobody chooses to develop a mental illness, right, guys?
This is one of the trainers, Deputy Randall Hopp.
So try and keep that in mind. Show a little empathy. You know, even people experiencing behavioral health crisis can respond positively to kind and patient behavior.
A key element of this training is its focus on dealing with people who do not have firearms. They're armed with knives, bats, pipes, chains, and other hazards, but nothing that can become deadly as quickly as a gun. That gives the officers more opportunity to try and de-escalate. If the other person's got a gun, everything changes.
Nothing prevents deputies from taking immediate action, right? We are here at de-escalation training, right? But if someone's life is on the line or immediate risk of serious bodily injury or whatever it might be, you need to take action. That's what you signed up to do, okay?
That's Deputy Scott Rotman, another trainer with the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department. One of his lessons was on the new law Governor Gavin Newsom had just signed, the one that says police can only use deadly force when it's necessary to defend themselves or another person. For the most part, Scott tells them, the new law isn't much different from the policy their department already has in place.
If you act within our policy, I think we're still going to be good.
But he emphasizes an element of the new law that makes this de-escalation training especially important.
The one thing I would know, and I think it's good on both sides, your actions before you actually shoot somebody and the suspect's actions, right, are going to matter now. And that's good. So if you've shown that, you're trying to de-escalate a situation, all that type of stuff, that's good stuff.
A recurring theme in this training room and throughout months of debate in the state capitol has been that a lot of police work involves responding to people in mental crisis. Depression, substance abuse, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress. Police have been asking for more training so they can better help people with these kinds of conditions. Californians have shared heartbreaking stories about police killing distressed people they were called to help. The legislature responded by passing two bills meant to reduce police shootings, one that limits when police can use deadly force, and another that increases officer training. Now that the governor has signed them into law, a key question is how much difference they'll make in the ways officers deal with people who are mentally ill. That's what we'll explore in this episode of Force of Law, a podcast about police shootings and California's attempt to do something about them. I'm Laurel Rosenhall. It's hard to say exactly how many people who die in police shootings were living with a mental illness. That's partly because the federal government doesn't do a good job of collecting the data, and partly because psychiatric problems can be difficult to track. Sometimes a mental illness goes undiagnosed. Other times, family members don't want to make it public. But the research that is available makes a compelling case that people with mental health problems are a large portion of the people police kill. The Washington Post and The Guardian compiled national data that suggests they're roughly one-fifth. California's Department of Justice reports that 17% of the people police killed between 2016 and 2018 had a known mental illness. And an internal review by the Los Angeles Police Department found that more than a third of people police shot in 2015, not all of them fatal, had documented signs of mental illness. It amounts to a lot of news stories like this.
In California, protesters took to the streets overnight, calling on police to release the video showing the killing of an out-of-control but unarmed man who may have been mentally ill.
25-year-old Desmond Anthony Phillips suffered from mental illness and had some short-term memory loss, as well as seizures from previous head trauma.
He said his cousin, Kenneth French, who was killed, was nonverbal and called him a gentle giant.
These kinds of stories were also part of the public ceremony on the day Governor Newsom signed the bill to limit the use of deadly force.
You see, my mother suffered from schizophrenia. Ultimately, the vulnerability of her own mental illness led to her untimely killing.
A few days later, the governor sat down with me for an interview about the new law. I asked him how much difference it'll make in the way police respond to people in mental crisis.
Signing a piece of paper doesn't make a difference in terms of ultimately addressing how we train our officers specifically to address the issues of people that are self-medicating, where we need to train those officers in ways we haven't. We have a major issue with homelessness, and we are increasingly requiring our police officers to be social workers.
Newsom points out that he's put an additional $35 million into police training so officers can get up to speed on the new deadly force standard and learn techniques for helping people with mental disorders. But he adds, it will take a while to train every officer.
That's a long-term process, and we have to make sure we're held to account and making sure we steward that process.
Still, he says, the high-profile debate over changing the deadly force standard has by itself made officers aware that the state's leaders want fewer shootings.
There's not a law enforcement officer that's not familiar with this. So already, I think it's having an impact.
I also asked Brian Marvel, the president of California's largest police officers union, what difference he thinks the new laws and the training money will make in how officers treat people who are mentally ill.
Yeah, I think you'll see a more concerted effort to train on identifying mental health issues, and not just mental health issues. You have issues with people that are autistic, people that can be slow learners, could be a variety of other issues that maybe have displays of mental health issues, but maybe related to other types of physical disabilities. So I think when you have officers who are trained to be able to identify some of those symptoms, they can maybe do different tactics versus the approach of, you know, this person's being violent and I need to defend myself.
It'll probably take years before we can assess whether the new legal standard and the enhanced training have decreased the number of police shootings in California. To get a sense of how the changes may affect shootings of people in mental crisis, I decided to examine two cases from the past, one that the new standard would likely prohibit, and another that the law seems less likely to change. After the break, I'll bring you those two stories, told in two chapters. This is a quick break to tell you about another criminal justice podcast called 70 Million. It examines reforms cities and states are trying, like eliminating cash bail and overturning wrongful convictions. One episode focuses on a program in California that's trying to keep foster youth out of jail. And the podcast is open source, so it's great for teachers, organizers, and community media makers because it means you can use and share all the original resources on the 70 Million website for free. 70 Million is produced by Lantigua Williams & Company and funded by the MacArthur Foundation's Safety and Justice Challenge. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Chapter 1, Teresa Sheehan. The Sheehan siblings grew up on an American military base in Japan in the years following World War II. Their father was an American service member, and their mother was Japanese. Teresa was the second of five children.
She was very, very bright. She was in the Honor Society. She was student council. She was very active.
This is Teresa's sister, Patricia Sheehan, who now lives in San Francisco. I interviewed her with another sister, Frances Sheehan, who you will hear from in just a bit.
And it was in college where she had her mental issues. I remember her calling me and say she hadn't been able to sleep for two or three, four nights in a row. And that was the first inkling, when I look back, that there was something going on.
Teresa had left Japan to attend college in New York. Eventually, she moved to San Francisco and was diagnosed with a serious condition.
She has schizophrenia affect disorder, which I guess is the highest of the mental illness spectrum.
In 2008, Teresa was living in a group home for people with mental disabilities. She'd been off her medication for a while, and the social worker who ran the house noticed that she wasn't taking care of herself. She wasn't acting like herself either. One day in August, he went to check on Teresa in her room, and she got angry. Here's Frances Sheehan.
The house manager said she threatened him, probably threatened, "I'll kill you. Gonna get out or I'll kill you." He in turn called non-emergency police for backup to take her to the hospital.
Two officers arrived, and the social worker showed them to Teresa's room. They used a key to open her door and found Teresa lying on her bed.
She was on the bed reading, and she probably just wanted to be left alone. And when they went in there, she felt like she was being violated. Her space was being invaded.
Teresa got up from the bed and grabbed a knife from a plate of food. She began yelling at the officers, threatening to kill them. The officers retreated back into the hallway, and Teresa closed the door. Now, this is a critical moment in this story as we consider what may change in California under the new law allowing police to use deadly force only when necessary in defense of human life. At this moment, Teresa was in her room alone, and the officers were on the other side of a locked door. Their lives were not in imminent danger.
the police officers were told backup would come, stand down, and wait.
But they didn't do that.
The police officers broke into her room, you know, with force. And that's when Teresa got up, from my understanding, based on information, and was petrified.
Teresa still had the knife in her hand. She stepped toward the officers. One of them pepper sprayed her, but it had no effect.
They went in there and started shooting.
She had 14 bullet holes in her. The chief surgeon said that each one of those bullets should have killed her, and she lived. She survived.
Teresa was in the hospital with serious injuries to her leg and face. Then police came and took her into custody.
They did arrest her, charged her with 5 felonies.
Teresa's legal saga went on for years and eventually prompted a landmark court ruling about how police must treat people with mental disabilities. I'll tell you more about it in just a minute. But first, I want to pause here and reflect on what Teresa's case shows about what may change in California under the new law limiting the use of deadly force.
You know, that's a situation that could have turned out differently under the standards of AB 392.
This is Peter Babring, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, who lobbied for the new law. The officers who shot Teresa said their fears about the situation increased after they were in the hallway behind the closed door, because they didn't know if Teresa had access to more weapons or could escape through a window. That's how they explained the decision to enter her room the second time. Once inside, of course, they faced an agitated, knife-wielding person who they knew had a mental illness. Though Teresa's attorney argued that the police put themselves in unnecessary danger by breaking into her room, the district attorney ruled that their decision to shoot was legally justified.
Under AB 392, a decision maker would look at the officer's actions leading up to the shooting, including their decision to break down the door, in evaluating whether the shooting was necessary.
That's going to change how prosecutors, police chiefs, and juries analyze an officer's decision to shoot.
The standard shifts the question from, was it reasonable for officers to shoot somebody holding a knife who was right in front of them, to, was there something a reasonable officer would have done to de-escalate the situation or avoid the shooting? And in that case, there certainly may have been things, including calling a specialized team that had a social worker rather than breaking down the door themselves, or engaging in de-escalation tactics before breaking down the door.
Okay, now back to Teresa's legal saga. She was in a wheelchair recovering from the gunshots when she went on trial in San Francisco Superior Court on 5 felony counts. The jury was not convinced that she had committed any crimes. They found her not guilty of threatening the social worker and were split in favor of acquittal on charges she'd assaulted the officers.
It was 11-1 for Teresa.
With the criminal trial behind her, Teresa filed a civil suit against the San Francisco police. Her case wound up going all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
We'll hear argument next this morning, case 13-14-12, the City and County of San Francisco versus Sheehan.
Two questions were at issue in the case. One was whether Teresa could sue the officers individually, or if they were entitled to qualified immunity that would shield them from personal liability. On that question, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the police, finding that the officers had acted reasonably and could not be personally sued. The other question was whether the Americans with Disabilities Act requires that police provide accommodations when they're dealing with people they know are mentally ill. That could include talking calmly, giving them more space, or seeking assistance from a psychiatric specialist. The Supreme Court decided not to rule on that question, instead allowing the appellate court ruling to stand. And that court found in Teresa's favor.
In the Ninth Circuit said, well, if the opportunity presents itself and you can make reasonable accommodations before using deadly force, then you should have done that.
This is John Burris, a civil rights attorney who represented Teresa.
They didn't have to rush in when they rushed in because they had the place was essentially secured. She had nowhere to go. And the court basically said that reasonable accommodations could have been made. That is to say, wait until a third person could get there, the caseworker, and see if you can reduce the confrontation that way.
Teresa won $1 million settlement in a ruling that legal experts see as a landmark in establishing rights for people with mental disabilities in their interactions with police. In the years since she was shot, many police departments, including San Francisco, have begun teaching officers to de-escalate situations involving people who are mentally ill. A lot of them use a technique known as crisis intervention training. San Francisco credits that, in part, for a 30% drop in its use of force.
We're really focusing on giving them tools and making sure they understand the concepts of de-escalation, of communication, and other tactics that try to slow a situation down and give folks time to, you know, hopefully come down from whatever mental crisis that they're having.
Mike Radford oversees crisis intervention training for the state agency that trains peace officers. He told me that statewide, only about a quarter of California's 80,000 law enforcement officers have had this kind of training since 2015.
So with the training that they're given, I think they're doing a great job, and it's only going to enhance with, you know, upcoming training that will be offered to them.
I wondered what Teresa thought about all this, but she declined my invitation for an interview. Her sister said she's never really recovered from the trauma of being shot, jailed, and put on trial. This is Patricia.
Her dignity was destroyed at that point, and I don't think she's ever really truly gotten it back. That's what hurts me the most, is that they treated my sister as someone that could be pushed aside and thrown away, and that she wouldn't matter to anyone. And she does. Illness or not, she's still our sister. I'm sorry.
One thing I find striking about Teresa's case is how it intersects with two of California's most prominent politicians. At the time San Francisco police shot Teresa in 2008, Kamala Harris was the city's district attorney, and Gavin Newsom was its mayor. Harris is now a United States senator running for the Democratic presidential nomination. And Newsom is California's governor. I wondered if he had reflected on Teresa's shooting this year as he worked on crafting a new state law limiting police use of deadly force. I asked him about it during our interview.
We had a lot of these cases, and but I don't have the detailed memory. That we're talking well over a decade ago now, so forgive me.
I also asked Kamala Harris's campaign about Teresa's case, since as district attorney, her office cleared the officers involved and then prosecuted Teresa on criminal charges. They sent me a statement saying this: "It was the responsibility of the district attorney's office to pursue accountability for individuals who may have committed assault against police officers. When the jury deadlocked on assault charges, the office further reviewed the case and decided to drop it and not pursue a retrial."
I'm to the point where I just couldn't cast my vote for either one of them, no matter what, only because they didn't even have the courtesy to give 5 minutes to my sister, Frances, when she begged and begged to listen to what was going on with Teresa.
Chapter 2, Anthony Nunez.
So Anthony was born 5 weeks premature. His mother passed away from a massive heart attack due to drugs. He was just an infant baby, newborn.
This is Anthony's aunt, Sandy Sanchez. I interviewed her in a park near her home in San Jose.
My brother stepped up and said, "I'm going to raise my son." But my brother had a drug problem.
So their parents took Anthony in. When they died a few years later, Sandy welcomed Anthony into her family. He was five.
He then had a sister and a brother and a mom and dad who loved him, cared for him. I enrolled him in school. He was in heaven. Like, he had a family. He actually had a family. And I raised him as my own.
All that bouncing around in his early years left Anthony with questions that tugged at his heart.
He called me Ma. Not Mom, Ma. He goes, Ma, I wonder what my life would be if my mom was alive. And he would cry. He would do stuff that my kids didn't do, like, you know, just getting into trouble, staying after school, you know, getting detention, throwing water bottles at another kid, that kind of stuff, but nothing.
Anthony got into more serious trouble as he got older. He was arrested a couple times as a teenager, Sandy said, and eventually he did time in juvenile detention for stealing a car.
I cried a lot. I suffered for him because that's not who I raised. Like, my other kids don't get in trouble with the law. They don't do that. Like, what's wrong with you? What's going on with you?
By the spring of 2016, Sandy felt things were turning around. Anthony had come home. He had a girlfriend, a new job at a neighborhood market, and ambitions to join the Army.
Our family was back together again. Anthony was becoming the man that we raised him to be.
That summer, Sandy and her husband left town for a family reunion. Anthony was 18 by then. He stayed home with his brother and their cousin, who are a year older. A few days into her trip, Sandy got a call from home.
My nephew had called me and said, something's wrong with Anthony. He's not acting himself. What do you mean? He doesn't want to go to work. He missed like 2 or 3 days of work. I don't know what's wrong with him, but he just keeps looking at all the family pictures.
The next morning, Sandy got on the phone with Anthony.
I talked to him. What's wrong, babe? What's going on with you? I don't know, Mom. Just sad. He goes, I just miss you. I want you to come home. The house isn't the same without you guys home. And I said, I know, mijo. I go, well, I miss you too. I go, we'll be home, mijo, tomorrow. I go, and I'll make you chile verde when I get home, I said. Okay, Mom. It was okay. I love you, Mom. I love you a lot. Mom, I love you more, son. I always tell my kids that I love you more. And that was the last call. That was the last time I talked to him.
Later that day, San Jose police got a frantic 911 call from Anthony's cousin, Juan Cervantes.
My cousin is trying to fucking kill himself.
And now, he has a gun?
Can you hurry up, please?
After some back and forth, the dispatcher sent officers to the home.
Cousin wants to kill himself. He does have a gun. We're still getting further on it.
Juan hung up and called back a few times. Operators were having trouble understanding his limited English.
What did Anthony do, sir? We're getting a translator. What did Anthony do? He shot himself?
Yeah, please come hurry up.
Anthony had shot himself in the head with an old revolver. Two bullets lodged under his scalp but did not penetrate his skull. He was bleeding and dazed, but alive, as emergency operators talked to his cousin with the help of an interpreter.
Translator, the officers want him to throw the gun into the backyard so they can come in.
Muy bien, la puede dejar usted en el patio.
¿En frente o atrás?
In the front or the back?
The backyard.
La parte atrás.
Since there's Spanish translation, we're trying to get him to throw it in the backyard, and he's advising he has thrown the gun into the backyard.
Police arrived and Juan went outside to talk to them. And then Anthony walked out the front door and onto the porch.
Subject to the front door, green shirt, does have a weapon in his right hand.
Copy one. Subject out the front door and a green shirt, weapon in the hand.
Ruben, can you still see a gun? I do. It's in his right hand. He's bleeding from the head.
An officer trained in crisis intervention talked to Anthony from across the street, urging him to drop the gun so police could help him. Anthony walked in and out of the house, but he didn't put the gun down.
He's standing up. He's injured on the head. He's bleeding from the head. He's not as responsive as we want him to be, but he still has the weapon in his hand.
Two other officers were positioned nearby with rifles pointing toward the front door.
6-4-William-3.
Shot fired.
I copy, shot fired.
William 3, he's down on the front porch. Doesn't appear to be moving.
Copy, the subject is down on the front porch, not moving. And 6-4-William-3, just confirm, did we shoot or did he shoot himself?
It's an officer involved shooting. Stand by for further.
Copy, officer involved.
A year later, the district attorney ruled that the officers were legally justified in shooting Anthony. The report says the officers saw Anthony raise his gun, twirl it around his finger, and point it at them as they looked through the scopes of their rifles. The move amounted to an imminent threat that justified the officers' use of deadly force, the district attorney said. Then Sandy filed a civil suit against the police. Her case raised serious questions about whether Anthony had pointed the gun at the officers.
There was a factual dispute as to what he did with that gun.
This is attorney John Burris again. He also represented Sandy.
You know, we had a witness who says he didn't do anything with that gun. He had that gun at his side because I didn't even see it. The two officers said that he was spinning the gun like he was a cowboy of some kind and getting ready to use it. And then they shot.
The eyewitness testimony moved the jury. In July 2019, it ruled that the officers used excessive force and recommended the city pay Anthony's family $2.6 million. The city filed court papers indicating it's likely to appeal the verdict, so Sandy and her family are preparing for the fight to continue. Every time they walk up to the front door of their house, they see a reminder of the shooting, a bullet hole in the stucco right above the doorbell.
It's been 3 years. But the pain doesn't ease up, even with this huge win. People keep telling me, you know, you got justice. No, I didn't. That's not justice. Justice would be me having my son back. How do you put a dollar amount on the life of an 18-year-old kid that wasn't doing anything but needing help, asking for help? How do you put a price tag on that?
Sergeant Paul Kelly of the San Jose Police Department said the officers tried to help Anthony. They brought a crisis intervention specialist who was trying to calm him down.
They did their jobs. They did their jobs professionally, and they have to live with that day for the rest of their lives.
Paul is the president of the San Jose Police Officers Association.
It's upsetting for the fellow officers and the police family to hear of such a bad verdict. If Nunes made the decision not to point the gun at the officers, I know there wouldn't have been a shooting, and we would have kept talking to him, because that's what we do.
San Jose has embraced crisis intervention training to teach officers how to de-escalate situations involving people in mental distress. Paul said roughly three-quarters of San Jose police have had the training known as CIT.
In San Jose, every single day, we're dealing with someone in a mental crisis using CIT every day, sometimes 5, 10 times a day. This is totally normal. The problem is there is still anywhere from 300 to 400 San Jose officers that are not CIT trained.
Paul thinks they'll get trained in the next couple years because of the new state laws and more money in the budget for officer training. Would more training or a tougher standard for using deadly force have made a difference in Anthony's case? It's hard to draw that conclusion. The question of whether the shooting was necessary depends on if you believe the police argument that Anthony pointed a gun at them or the eyewitness testimony that he didn't. Under the necessary standard, a prosecutor who believed the police officer's account would likely still justify the use of deadly force, because the new law allows police to shoot in defense of human life. And under the necessary standard, a civil rights attorney with evidence that officers' lives were not in imminent danger would likely sue for excessive force. So in this case, I'm not convinced it would make much difference. Sandy isn't either.
They watered down the bill. They made it a weak bill. So I'm not happy about that.
I first met Sandy early in 2019 when she was lobbying for the bill to limit when police can shoot. She's friends with Lori Valdez. You heard from her in earlier episodes when she described how San Jose State University police shot her partner when he wouldn't drop the saw blade he was holding. Sandy was one of the women rubbing Lori's back when she watched the video of her partner shooting for the first time. Together, they trekked to Sacramento to advocate for the bill. They packed into hearing rooms, told their stories to legislative aides, and marched through Capitol hallways.
there's something in us that says you have to do this to make a difference.
We have no choice.
Sandy wishes there was a way to call for help when someone is suicidal without having the police respond.
I don't think the police are the ones that should show up when you're having a mental breakdown.
Some police have begun to rethink this too, though maybe not in the same way.
A person who's suicidal is really in need, and they're looking for help. And we really encourage law enforcement officers to make sure that they are giving that person help by either having communication, backing off and giving them time and space.
This is Mike Radford again, the crisis intervention expert from the state agency that trains police.
It's really become a known law enforcement practice that if someone is intent on hurting themselves, won't follow the instruction of law enforcement officers, law enforcement may be forced to just walk away.
That's the approach in the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department, where I attended the de-escalation training you heard at the start of this episode. When they finished a day packed with classroom lessons and role-playing exercises in the woods, I asked Deputy Jordan Siegel if he'd ever had a situation in real life where someone was suicidal and he decided not to intervene.
We've definitely had a couple where we've gone through the training that we've had here. You know, is anyone else in the house? Are they a danger to anyone else? What's the danger to us going in the house? Could we cause them more harm by doing that? I've been to at least two or three calls where we've just determined that it's too great a risk for us and harming them. And we've walked away. You know, we tried to call them, leave them information, things like that. But going into a house to hurt someone, to save them, to put us in harm's way, it just doesn't make sense at a certain point.
It'll take a long time before we can assess whether California's new laws have improved police interactions with people in mental crisis. But when it comes to social change, there are very few watershed moments. More typically, many small changes happen over the course of a long time. A court ruling here, a piece of legislation there. Eventually, perhaps after some zigging and zagging, they begin to add up. Teresa Sheehan's court ruling won some new protections for people with mental disabilities. It's a significant legal development, but it hardly stopped police from shooting people who are mentally ill. California's new deadly force law may have similar effects. Next month, I'll be back with the final episode of Season 1 of Force of Law. We'll look at how Seattle has changed since it set a tougher standard for police to use deadly force, and explore what that may mean for California's future. You're listening to Force of Law, a production of CalMatters and Studio Tibi. I'm your host, Laurel Rosenhall. Brian Howie is our producer. Cheryl Duvall is our editor. Ray Ortega engineered this episode. Robbie Short is our researcher. David Lesher of CalMatters and Joaquin Alvarado and Kristen Belden of Studio Tibi are the executive producers. You heard original music by Eli Chambers and additional music by Lee Rosevier and Remember the Future.
We appreciate the use of U.S. Supreme Court recordings from Oyez.org, a multimedia archive affiliated with the Cornell Law School.
Thank you to Chloe Behrens and Zach Marino from Squadcast.